and through that bliss to recognize yourself too, find yourself. And Robert loved chanting. I love chanting. And so you're all subjected to it, whether you like it or not. Even those people that complained about my chanting while the chanting is going on. So when this chant comes on, if you can, chant with it. Participate. Just don't listen.
Jai Jagadambe, Ma Durga. Jai Jagadambe, Ma Durga. Jai Jagadambe, Ma Durga. Durga, Jai Jagadambe, Jai Madurga, Jai Jagadambe, Jai Madurga, Jagadambe, Ma Durga. Jagadambe, Ma Durga. Jagadambe, Ma Durga. Durga, E Ma Durga.
Jagadambe Ma Durga, Jagadambe Ma Durga.
Are we going to have Gopala now? Or do you think maybe the short version of Sitaram? Which do you prefer? Okay.
Gopala, Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala. Gopala, Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Gopala, Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Devaki Nandana Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala. Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Devaki Nandana Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Gopala, Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala. Gopala, Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Gopala, Gopala, Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Devaki Nandana Gopala.
Greetings from San Fernando Valley, porno capital of the United States. Pretty soon we're going to suffer another new year, same as the last fucking year. It'll be exactly the same, maybe worse, but we'll be happy because we don't care. Joanne will get rid of all of her programs. We'll never see her again. She'll be blissfully happy. She's insane now, but she'll be blissfully happy then. Joan will have killed her husband, drowned the kids, and will have an ashram at her house. all 5,000 square feet of it, in Berryville, Virginia, population 15. Just outside of that huge town, what is it, Fredericksburg or Wickenburg or some burg with a huge population of 10,000 people, right outside of Washington, D.C., power center of the world. Then we'll make our move. Sarin in the subways, just like the Chinese. We'll show them what a real cult can do. Get the Kool-Aid ready. Happy New Year. Almost. Got a comment left on the blog today by Randy. And Randy said, you shouldn't talk about your experience because people will listen to your experience and compare their experience to your experience. And he says that's why he doesn't have a teacher, because he doesn't want to compare his experience, I guess, to a teacher's experience and be bothered by all that. But you know, there's no way you can't have a teacher. If you read books by Ramakrishna, by Krishnamurti, by Nisargadatta, by Ramana, you have a teacher. There is none of the great teachers that haven't had a teacher. Except Ramana. Robert. They had teachers after they had an awakening. But not before. But almost everybody else has had a teacher. Nisargadatta had a teacher. U.G. Krishnamurti had several teachers, all of whom he rejected. But he still had teachers. He hung around Krishnamurti for many years. He went to see Ramana Maharshi. He had a meeting with Ramana. And he asked Ramana, can you give me what you have? He had no idea what Ramana Maharshi's experience was like. And Ramana replied in a smart-ass way, I can give it to you, but can you take it? What the fuck does that mean? You know, I think I'm one of the few teachers around that does talk about his experience. Everybody else talks in terms of concepts. About the absolute, about the relative, about the I am, about the I word, about the sense of presence. But there's no real experience. They don't talk about much their experiences with their guru. Nisargadatta talks about he trusted his guru. He visited him, but nothing really about their relationship. So Randy said, all the greatest teachers taught in silence. Well, you mean like Krishna, who talked to Arjuna on the battlefield constantly, the Bhagavad Gita? You mean like Ramana, who spent 60 years talking about his enlightenment experience? You mean Robert, who left 3,700 pages of texts and of his talks? Who are these great ones that taught in silence? Who are the greatest ones that taught in silence? They all used words, concepts, and a rare few talked about their experiences. Nisargadatta talked about his experiences in that little booklet, Self-Knowledge and Self-Realization, about his path up to his awakening through devotion, etc. But Randy's wrong. You can't help but compare your experiences with other people's. And if you read books of the teachers, Papaji or whoever, you're always wondering what his experience was because he's not really talking about it. And Krishnamurti talks in questions. What is it like to live without a bounded mind, to live without a thought structure? To live in the immediacy and the passion of the present. Well, I don't know. Tell me, what was your experience, Krishnamurti? So I speak of my experiences rather than concepts. I try to keep the concepts to a minimum, music to a maximum, And my experience, I throw a lot of that in there just because where else can I speak from? There's one other thing. I've never really liked the term master or guru or all of that kind of shit. And I guess that's because of my relationship with Robert. Ramana Maharshi did not have a teacher. And Robert had an awakening before he had a teacher. And then he traveled for many years to find all the nuances of his understanding of what his enlightenment experiences meant. And also Robert had one final awakening, according to Mary, during the last year of his life, and I don't know what that was, and she never told it to me. But over and over again, Robert would tell me. Matter of fact, he told me this at the beginning. Ed, I have lots of devotees, but I need a friend. Somebody I could talk to. About day-to-day things. He didn't have a friend. And so he made me his friend. And that's our relationship. I wasn't a devotee. He treated me like an equal. He treated me to lunch. We were equals. Like Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield. Krishna driving the cart. Arjuna with the spear and the sword. Arjuna is filled with doubt. And Krishna said, you can either have me as a friend, or you can have my armies to battle for you. And he chose to have Krishna as his friend and mentor. And that's how I relate to you. Not as a teacher so much, a guru, but a friend, an equal. And that confuses a lot of people because it's the dichotomy of master-teacher isn't here. I regard all of you as equals. All of us are equally crazy. This doesn't mean that all of our relationships are out of control because no one is in charge. Because those relationships where somebody's in charge tend to be very closed relationships. What I'm talking about here is a very open relationship on both sides. Relationship from the heart, from silence, from emptiness. Meeting in emptiness. Neither of us know where we're going. Neither of us really care where we're going, as long as we're together. Do you understand this? The difference? There's no security here. I don't know where the fuck I'm going. I don't care. But I know I'm happy. Every day is happier. And I feel the raining down of bliss every day. And even more of a sanctifying grace that sweeps me away. And when there's no me, in terms of an Ed, how can I know where I'm going? It's all God's grace that determines where I'm going, where you're going, where we're going. The safety and security is not in our relationship, but the trust and consciousness in God. If it were up to me, nothing at all would happen. I direct nothing. I really don't care where we're going. But what a ride. What a ride. Joanne, did you expect to be here a year ago? Joan? Either John? John. Tina's still asleep. So that's the one constant. Oh, no, she says she's not. So it's not you go with me at your own peril, because we're being watched and taken care of. But there will be a lot of shit happening in your life as you leave the old patterns and go to no patterns, or go to patterns that come from silence, from your emptiness, from the stillness of the heart, the silence of the heart, where the mind isn't no longer controlling and imposing patterns and shoulds and oughts and conditions. They'll just be verbs, no nouns, no adjectives, no constraints, just action verbs. Of course, such actions may be sleep, lying on a couch, listening to chanting. But they certainly won't be done because you should do something. The shoulds will arise from your own heart. I should take care of that cat. I should take care of that child. I should take care of that Republican representative. It will rise instantaneously, spontaneously from our hearts. There'll be no boundaries in terms of the mind. Much is made of learning to see the world as a child sees, innocently, simply, compared with all the burdens we carry of concepts, etc. But just see how innocent a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old really is as they bash each other for their favorite toy, or hang on to you and say, I want a cookie. I want a cookie. No, I don't want that cookie. I want another cookie. It's all impulse. It's all rage. It's all love. None of it's tamed. Is that what you want to return to? The innocence of childhood? The ideal is to develop fully as an adult, to feel those impulses and to control them, to have learned to control and what fulfilling every impulse means in terms of the destruction of your life. And after you've fully become and matured as an adult, to be able to then say, hey, I've done all this shit. I've done this in the world. I've done that in the world. I feel fully grown up, fully confident. I'm happy. Now I'm released. Now I can get away from all those shoulds and live innocently. Not with the mind, but with the heart. The feeling is we go inside, into the emptiness inside, and we take up a position. Right from the heart, from the chest. And we watch all the shit happen. Every moment's fresh. An emotion comes up, and you see it for what it is. Same with a thought. Living from the heart, the silence of the heart. That's topic one. Moving on to topic two. You know, probably every one of you has read both Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta. Everybody considers them the two greatest contemporary Advaita masters. And I can assure you, everybody is confused by the difference between them. Everybody assumes that they're the same, but there's an incongruity in their different teachings that just bugs the hell out of people. They can't put their finger on it. They have very different teachings. And I assume very different experiences. Unexplainable differences. And neither of them really talk about their experience. Just their conclusions. So we have no way of judging which is higher or lower, more complete, less complete. We just choose one, or we choose the other, or we choose both, or we choose neither. For example, Nisargadatta is very clear. The body is real. It's made out of atoms. It's a product of food we eat. Sentience creates a body, body-mind, that grows up, develops a sense of I at the age of two or three, the I sense, which is the nucleus between universal consciousness and our individual consciousness. We grow up and we mature, and then we decide to seek spirituality and find out who we really are. So he tells us to pay attention to the I sense. And we pay attention to the I sense. And one day, by loving it, by attending to it, it disappears. And we become the absolute with no affect, no love, just pure knowingness and the recognition that we're beyond this world. The I concept, the I am, is a concept, and consciousness itself is a concept. Very simple. It's very much, very Western in the sense of realism, where you believe the mind and consciousness are an epiphenomena or generated by the body, by the brain. Very similar. In many ways, not completely, because the Western concepts don't have, Western philosophy does not have the concept of being a witness to the whole process of consciousness. I'm oversimplifying it, but just to make a point. Ramana, on the other hand, talks about the I-I. And that our practice is almost identical to that of Nisargadatta. But the conclusions are very different. For Ramana, you as I are to look within and follow the I thought to where it goes, where it disappears. Just keep following the I thought or asking yourself, who am I, and wait for an answer to rise up from the emptiness within. You just follow the I sense down, 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 down through various levels of consciousness until you reach the fourth state, Turiya state. The body's not real. Body does not generate consciousness. Consciousness contains the body. The body sprouted out of consciousness. Everything is consciousness. The camera you're looking at is consciousness. Your own body is consciousness. It's just something that you're witnessing. Everything you eat is consciousness. All of your thoughts are in your consciousness. The void is watched by you, the ultimate I. It too is consciousness, an object within consciousness. Consciousness is everything. Consciousness is awareness. Consciousness is you, and it's not you. It's non-dual. And yet, there's a core that feels like I. For Ramana, it's real. It's not a thought. It's not just a concept. For Ramana, it's real. It's the pathway to Turiya. It's the path following downwards, that sense of I. That sense of I is real. That's the core of the universe. You might say it's almost equivalent to Nisargadatta's concept of the Absolute. But actually, Ramana has a concept of going beyond Turiya, the fourth state, to Turiyanatta, or I don't remember how you pronounce it, which is the absolute you, beyond awareness, beyond consciousness. And in that sense, although he still considers it consciousness, it's similar to the absolute of Nisargadatta, but it's a different model altogether, because nothing is real but consciousness for Ramana, including your body. It appears to come out of the seed, out of the egg and the fertilization process and is given birth. But that's outward appearance. What's actually happened is impersonal processes in consciousness producing a baby. And impersonal processes in the baby producing an ego. And when the person grows up, they as I, the sense of control, can begin the process of turning inward and investigating the inward processes, including that I sense, as well as everything else inside, the chakras, the sense of I arising in the heart or near the heart. Most of us feel when we have a sense of I that it's in the heart, some between in the third eye. But for Ramana, the I sense is real. It's the path to enlightenment, is to follow that I down, 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 down. Now, if we go to Nisargadatta's teacher, Siddharameshwar, it's a similar story there. You follow the I through various levels, the subtle body, the causal body, to the absolute. There's one other body. I forget what the name of it is. Many different conceptual structures. The practice, though, is universal. Staying in the I. Abiding in the I. Or pursuing the I. But there are different epistemologies and different ontologies involved. For Nisargadatta, consciousness is not real. For Ramana, it's everything. For Nisargadatta, the I sense is not real. It it's ultimately an illusion that dissolves into the absolute. For Ramana, the I sense is there are two eyes, the small eye of the ego and the eye of the absolute, or the Tiryanatta. And you're to follow that downwards to liberation. Neither of them explain their experiences. Neither of them explain their experiences. We have nothing to judge. We trust the method. It's the only thing, is to trust the method. And it's such a natural method. Find out who you are. Spend 30 years. Or listen to the Neophytians that say, well, take a look inside for 5 or 10 seconds and you'll see there's no eye, you're free. So many concepts, so many teachers, so many assholes. Now, we agree on a method, looking for the eye. The method should be king. Trust the method. So many have advised it. I tell you in my website what happens to me doing it. And it wasn't doing that got me awakened. It was lying on a couch, listening to sacred music, and just looking within and resting within and just looking around inside into the emptiness. It's sort of like self-inquiry, I guess. And the secondary consideration was that there was a crisis in my life. Robert had left. My teacher had left. I was alone. And often awakening happens when there's a crisis. But listening to the sacred music, lying on a couch and introspecting was definitely a part of it, as well as the 20 years of self-inquiry before that. Even though when the awakening happens, it doesn't feel as if any effort you made in consciousness was at all relevant to the awakening. That's topic 2. How about, hey, Bhagavan?
Hey, Bhagavan, hey, Bhagavan, hey.
Satsang for a year or so, 6 months, really feel pretty happy. You know you don't know where you're going, but there's a sense of grace. That we're being taken by benevolent forces. Oop, that hurts a little. Not get down. Oh, that hurts. And sometimes not benevolent forces. We feel carried, protected, safe. We'll be taken care of. It feels that way. Dropping the shoulds, the oughts. Dropping the race for prestige and getting ahead in the world or getting behind. We're protected. God's grace. The grace of consciousness. Robert used to call it the power that knows the way. The world is unfolding as it should. And often that means, though, that you're very actively engaged in the world, rescuing animals, being a revolutionary. Still, there's the feeling that you're in your right place, doing the right thing for you, for the world, even if the world is an illusion. You still have a role. So the security comes within you as a gift. God shows you his way. Consciousness shows you its ways. And you trust. That's when you operate from the heart. When the mind and its shoulds is dropped, with all of its vows and affirmations and positive thinking, self-analysis. When all of that's dropped and you just live from the silence of the heart, everything is secure. It's like magic. Things show up like magic. Happened for Robert all the time. They'd need money for something or other, and it'd just mysteriously appear. It happens with us too, more and more. So, topic 3, Tiger's Cave. I think this is the appropriate part. Wait a second. This is a long reading. I really wish I had somebody to read this, but we have to wait for people to get copies of this so they can read it. Page 60, the Heart Sutra. It's the Tiger's Cave with Trevor Leggett, and it's the musings of a Zen abbot about the Heart Sutra. And he personalizes it, talking about what it means to him and his experiences. And the Heart Sutra itself is about the heart of the Buddhist doctrine. And for the Zen people, the heart, the chest, is where the eye is. Sense of self, separate sense of self. So it's the Heart Sutra in more than one way. It's about the heart and living in the heart or from the heart, with or without the eye, because they're both the same according to Zen. The emptiness, the eye comes from emptiness and returns to emptiness, but it's still there. No need to destroy it. Just by recognizing that its very nature is emptiness, nullifies it, nullifies the greed, the hostility. Anyway, page 60. The world of emptiness, and I talk about emptiness a lot because I was in Zen for 20 years. So emptiness is a constant experience for me, awake or asleep, eyes open, eyes closed. I always feel it, a kind of spaciousness that's inside of me and around me everywhere that permeates all forms, and forms are permeated by it. Forms come out of emptiness and they go back into emptiness or into the unknowing, as Rajiv puts it. The world of emptiness is not some world without crying and without laughing. Emptiness in the tears themselves, emptiness in the smiles themselves. This is real emptiness. Then the phrase is turned around. The sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Feeling, thoughts, and consciousness are also like this. In other words, feeling, thoughts, and consciousness are permeated by emptiness. They come from emptiness. They disappear into emptiness. But the sprouting out of the emptiness is what gives them form, its meaning, its life. And he says, then the phrase is turned around. Emptiness is not different from form. When with all my might I plunge what is called myself into the heart of Kanyan, Bodhisattva. Kanyan is also known in Sanskrit as Avalokiteshvara. And in the Japanese, it's Kanyan Bodhisattva. Kanyan is one of the first and most important of the Bodhisattvas. Buddhism has many streams, but the two most famous are the Hinayana, or small vehicle, and the Mahayana, or the larger vehicle. The Hinayanas really don't like hearing of their vehicle called the smaller vehicle. But the thing is for the Bodhisattvas, you don't just save yourself as with the Hinayanas. You save all sentient beings. So the concept is that the Bodhisattva is a saint who will risk his own salvation to give it to others before he takes it himself or she takes it himself. She is more concerned about the benefit and the realization and the taking care of the other than of herself, the Bodhisattva. And there are two. There's Kuan Yin, who is the goddess of compassion, and Kanyan, who is the Avalokiteshvara. It's sort of the first of the great Bodhisattvas. Then the phrase is turned around. Emptiness is not different from form. When with all my might I plunge what is called myself into the heart of Kanyan Bodhisattva, and in that heart become completely knotted, negated. Then the laughter and the weeping called form can for the first time have a meaning. Only as emptiness have the forms their great meaning. When the form emerges from the emptiness, it's recognized. Now, just for today, let me try. And then the time when I wanted to burst forth like a thunderstorm, when I wanted to rage with the anger of erupting in me, just for today. And somehow I realized that blazing up for what it is, something which is blazing up. And then there was the taste of the state of liberation. He stopped. And he saw the form of rage arising within him from the emptiness in his chest. And he saw it for what it was. This rage was a form arising from emptiness. That I was unable to speak for that moment, with the ill feeling vanished, and from my heart there was no power of mine. It was the power of Kanyan. Through Kanyan's grace there came a breath from the Absolute. Emptiness is no different from form. The emptiness ate the rage. He saw it emerging from the emptiness. And from emptiness, he observed the emergence of the rage. And it was just the seeing of it. He felt the peace of the emptiness. Through Kanyan's grace, through the grace of emptiness, of the Absolute, there was a breath from the Absolute. And it negated the anger. This is taken out of context. It talks about what his experience was, but it'd be way too long to read the whole thing. Form and emptiness cannot be separated, however much one tries. And the life in which they are reconciled, the life of Kanyan, is expressed in the two phrases. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form here stands for all five skanda aggregates. That's... I don't want to get into it, but it's the things of which the world of manifest world are made of. The power which simply negates them is form, is emptiness. It is not only illusory clinging which is negated. The real emptiness is negation of what is called Buddha also. This is going to be hard to grasp. You're not going to get it the first time. what he's talking about is you have to negate not only the negative elements, but the positive elements, like the Buddha. Rage on the negative side and Buddha on the positive side. The power of negation begins with the five aggregates, but goes on to negate all, including the positive, including Buddha. Only thus in the world of supreme wisdom and light hinted at, it breaks the illusory clinging to the self and goes on to negate even the Buddha form. Kill the Buddha. You're free then. You're free from the negativity of your own emotions, and you're free from any path. You are your own path. If it stops short at the full Buddha form, it is not emptiness. Form as emptiness points to the state of ultimate negation. Only when there is that absolute negation will the next phrase be manifest. Emptiness is form. The affirmation of all conditions. Emptiness is force. Form is the affirmation of all conditions, including all that shit that's happening around you. When you see it's nothing, and you recognize its nothingness, automatically there's the acceptance of it. Because there is emptiness, there can be form. Therein is manifested the compassion of canon. It is to be noted carefully that in this sutra, the phrase form is emptiness comes first and emptiness is form comes afterwards. In the Diamond Sutra, similarly, the world of negation comes first and only then the world of affirmation. It is after the absolute negation that the so-called world of unconditional affirmation appears. The first phrase, form is emptiness, means this will not do, and that will not do, and never gives its assent. Then comes, this will do, and that will do. This is the world of emptiness is form. The affirmation of everything just as it is. First the power to condemn and then the power to let be. But these powers to condemn and to condone are never separate from each other. And then he goes on to tell all about his experience. Now you may have grasped this or not, but get the book and mull over this for a while. It'll be part, you know, continuing. This is a different point of view than Nisargadatta. I was frightened we were getting a little too nailed down into the Nisargadatta mold, and I want to break out of that and totally fuck you up and confuse you with an entirely different point of view, which is really the same. I remember how I felt when I was 44 years old and my old Zen teacher died. When I was young, I used to be scolded by both my parents and my teacher. But now my parents had come to praise me up and never scolded me anymore. It was only when the teacher, who still had a harsh word for me, and when he died, an inexpressible loneliness overcame me. 4 years previously, I'd gone back to my hometown, and I used to act as his assistant. At that time, I was fairly full of myself. Quite a name in Buddhist scholarship, they said. And then I had been a professor here and a headmaster there. Oh, I was pretty well satisfied with myself when I came home. I was one of those men of elevated views. I came home with the conviction that my wisdom was very far-reaching. But this teacher still saw me as the same runny-nosed youngster as before. Every day I used to scrub the floor and the teacher would come up behind and he'd say, "Look at that. What sort of cleaning is that supposed to be? All black and white patches, like a picture or something. The number one boy ought to be able to make a better job of the cleaning than that." Another time when I was supposed to have made a reply in the wrong, I supposedly made a reply in the wrong tone. He said, "If you still don't know how to answer properly, your spiritual training doesn't amount to much, does it?" I was scolded over everything. I remember one day an old lady came to the temple and told us she had brought the girl along with her. On asking how old the latter might be, she said, "Oh, she's 60. Certainly to an old lady of 80, the daughter of 60 is still a girl in spite of the wrinkles. A girl is a girl. Whatever the age may be, a girl is still a girl in the same way. to the teacher, I was still a little boy. However distinguished a countenance I had put on, however professorships I may have held, that was nothing to the teacher. I might feel myself a man of elevated views, but the teacher's comment was, if you still don't know how to answer properly, your spiritual training doesn't amount to much. Do some self-examination. Sometimes I used to feel, why doesn't the old man let up a little bit? Yeah, a little bit, just a bit, damn it. But when he died, I had this unutterable loneliness. Now there are so many to praise, but the teacher who was really kind to me, who used to hide his tears of love under his scoldings, is dead, and I am alone. Holy Canon is one of those who looked on all of his children and shows compassion for all, whoever they may be, whatever they may do. We have to face the fact of our illusions. We must realize our clinging attachment to the skanda aggregates for what it is. In other words, his clinging to his fame and his accomplishments. In this, his compassion for seeing things as they really are, he negates and negates. But when we come to realize we are nothing at all, then we have the experience of the sublime world of canon, which embraces all in an infinite forgiveness, infinite grace. In the bodhisattva world of emptiness and the world of form are not two. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And in these words, the Buddha speaks of the state of the bodhisattva canon. In the Genga Kon book of the Shobo Genzo, it is written, in the feeling of inadequacy of body and mind, the Dharma is fulfilled. Know also that in the feeling that the Dharma has been fulfilled by body and mind, there is yet something lacking. When we come to know Buddhism, to feel that we are, that it is well, that all is peace, is to set ourselves down in a state of so-called satori, means there is yet no real understanding of Buddhism. If we are really receptive to Buddhism, there is always the feeling of not enough, not enough. Limitless endeavor and striving continue age after age. That must be the spirit of Mahayana. There is no feeling of completion, not enough and still not enough. Gradually, self is negated and the world of liberation reveals itself. This is very different than Nisargadatta, yet they're expressing the same thing. Any questions, comments, complaints? Raise your hand if you have a complaint. Okay. John wants to. Grinish, however you pronounce his last name. Granola. Granola. I like granola. I can remember that. It's a mnemonic device for remembering him.
I take a lot of offense to your pronunciation.
Good. How else can we pronounce it? Grinovich, granola.
Well, originally it was. I'm Irish and Russian. So it was Grinovich and it got misspelled at Ellis Island. So. Yeah, very nice. What a wonderful, it's just, well, what comes out when you do this is just fantastic. When you were talking about emptiness is form and form is emptiness, it really hit home because at first, the impulse from here was to kind of like satori and go into the emptiness. And there's an old Zen expression. I don't know a lot about Zen, but I know this one expression that one student went to the teacher and said, "My friend is always in the emptiness. What should I tell him to do?" And he said, "Give up the emptiness." And so the whole for me right now, what I was saying to you last week about push that I. Is that okay? It's it's an illusion. It's not my illusion. It's just, and it's really not an illusion from the point of view of the absolute. The absolute is fine with it, but this is also it. It's like the hole in the, it's like what you were saying, the hole in the paper. Once that's seen, it's like, then what do you do? And there's always a sense of doing. I don't care what anyone says. And there's always a sense of ego. Not in the sense of a personal thing, but there's,
it's always a sense of mine. There's always a sense of there's me somewhere, either as an absolute witness, seeing the illusory nature of consciousness itself, or I as a person. That's what Ramana is talking about. You follow the eye. The eye is always there, and at one point becomes everything. I am everything. And then other times,
there's
I am
no
nothing.
Center. No
yes,
center
no center.
Anymore.
Right.
But there's even the sense of that the what he calls the eye of I, that's even not it. Because even beyond that, that's part of the manifestation, and even that thins out after a point.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it's all philosophy, as you say, and it's true. But there's some sense that's even beyond that, that, it's really not knowing and being comfortable with it.
Yes.
even though the apparent world has its demands, and I guess a lot of what I've been going through in the last in the last year and a half, just those demands and my wanting to just stay put, and it's kind of getting used to going to being out, and then it becomes a whirlwind in a sense. Like I can't plan a damn thing. I can't plan anything.
Right.
When I sit down to plan something, it.
I know. I know. I know.
And everyone around me that's still left, they look at it like I'm being spaced out.
Yes.
It's not spaced out anymore. For a while it was. I couldn't form a thought.
Yes.
Now I can kind of do that, but I'd much rather be just be. But there's a push, and I don't know what the hell to do.
I really have a hard time. When somebody says, can I Skype you tomorrow at 2? I have no idea what mind state I'm going to be in at 2 or where I'll be at 2. Because even though I have a really conventional life of Starbucks in the morning and usually leaving around 10:30, I have no idea what's going to happen at 2 or whether I'll really be up to any conversation. I may not be in the mood for it or something like that. And I know exactly what you're and we're all going through that.
Yeah.
Right, Joan? How much have you accomplished today? Yes. Yeah, just a second. Yeah. Unmute her. Yeah, John, you got it perfectly. You fully comprehend the text. You get a gold star today.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'll send it to you in the mail.
It was nice hearing it from you.
Yes, thank you. Joan, what have you done today?
Actually, you'd be really shocked.
Uh-oh, you did something.
I did. I did. I couldn't help it. I had to. I've been lazy for so many days. Everything was falling apart, and all the company finally left. So I became Hitler and ordered everybody around, and had to get some things done. Sorry. I'm a failure.
You are a failure.
What can I say?
Such a disappointment. But look at Tina. I'm sure Tina compensated by doing absolutely nothing today. And it's not a matter of doing nothing. It's a matter of you're doing whatever comes up. And if you're not moved, you're not moved. And if you were moved, you are moved.
Exactly.
And Joan hasn't been moved to do much recently, and now she's moved.
Just for one day.
Yes.
And
a lot of us are that, we're less and less in the world, but then something comes up and we can fully function in the world for the 3 or 4 days or however long it takes to get the task done. and then go back into this blessed silence. Except people that have a lot of kids. It's not so easy.
No.
Two kids.
Blessed silence here.
Yes. Or have a full-time job. Or have all of that. It's very difficult. Anybody else? Anything else? Any bitching, complaining? John Hanna, you're usually filled with things I should do. What are the suggestions today?
Oh, I have no suggestions, Edgy.
Okay.
I'm gonna shut up.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
I'm going to shut the fuck up.
That's not going to last long.
It'll last a couple of days.
But it's a good attempt. It's good. You get a silver star for attempting to shut up.
Okay.
I guess I should send the silver star to Tina, too, because she just doesn't say anything ever.
You'd be surprised.
Yes, not on satsang, you don't.
Oh, no, I really don't say a whole lot most
yes.
days.
Yes.
I like the quiet.
Yes, I know what you mean.
But I want to thank you for
You're welcome.
The year and all you've given us.
Mm.
I love you and each and everyone in the Sangha. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You've given me so much, too. All of you have. Now I want all the rest of you. I want everything. Take it all away. Throw it all away. Michael, how are you?
I'm all right.
Tell me what's going on with you.
Not much.
This is your opportunity to bitch, moan, complain, compliment, ask a question.
I'm good.
Okay. Anybody out there in computer land that I can't see have a question?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Very good.
How are you feeling today? Are you okay? How was satsang for you?
Nice, yeah. I have done the Heart Sutra on a study course once when I was involved in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a really good text.
Yes, it is. Because it's very personal. It's very personal.
Very, very profound, very deep.
Yes, it is. It is. The notion that negation, emptiness, actually accentuates the form and also neutralizes it at the same time. Just the observing of the arising of the forms nullifies it and yet makes it real at the same time.
Yeah, my mate had a peak experience when he was about 15 years old, and he kept repeating over and over, like, I understand everything, and it's like it is and it isn't, and this was his thing. It was that it was and that it wasn't at the same time, and I couldn't get a handle on it, and I didn't know what he meant. And then years later we both got into Tibetan Buddhism, and we got into studying this Majjhimika Prasangika view of emptiness, where I was reading on someone's website where they were doing this non-dual technique, and then they came to the conclusion that it wasn't one, it wasn't the other, but that it was both. That was the answer. But according to the Prasangika view, it's not that's then asserting some new position. It's not one, it's not the other, it isn't both, and it also isn't neither. That would be the full Prasangika view of that. So I was quite surprised that this guy had come to that conclusion and sort of asserted the position of it being both, rather than one or the other. That's kind of not the whole equation. That's the way I came to
understand
it intellectually.
There is a I've mentioned this at Satsang before, a famous koan called Gute's Finger. Have you heard of it?
No.
Gute, whenever people would ask him a question about the Dharma, he'd raise one finger. No matter what they ask him, what is the Buddha? One finger. What is Nirvana? One finger. What is emptiness? One finger. And he had a student. This is called one. What the name of the koan is? What is Gute's One Finger Zen? And the student had been with him many years, and everybody recognized that he was a senior student of Gute. And so people started asking him questions. What is Buddha? And he held up one finger. What is enlightenment? He held up one finger. What is the way? He held up one finger, just like his teacher. He didn't know what the fuck it meant. He knew the observables, the behaviors. So Gute, seeing this, snuck up behind him one day when he was answering people in the crowd. And he grabbed his hand after he had somebody ask him, what is Buddha? And he put up one finger. Gute grabbed the student's hand and with a knife cut the finger off. Now, you're supposed to answer the koan. What is Gute's finger, Zen, one finger Zen? What does it mean? I struggled with that koan a long, long time. I even gave my Zumi the answer one time when I was getting frustrated. But that finger didn't mean that much back then. He just hit me with the stick. But the proper answer is sometimes this, sometimes this, sometimes this, sometimes this, sometimes this, sometimes this, sometimes this. That's for you, Mark. You got that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And for the rest of you, my one finger, Ed's one finger Zen.
We can do that one. I wanted to do one of the Yogananda ones, the Only You. I love that one. Maybe I Will Be Thine Always, yes.
I am singing to you, my Lord, I will be thine always. Sing this song through the whisper of your heart, with all the heart-breaking devotion of your soul. Then he will ever be with you, from everywhere, within and without. You will feel his presence. My Lord, I will be thine all over. My Lord, I will be thine all over. I may go far, far
than thine.
When I die, look into
I wanted to ask the people that have been coming for 6 months or so or more, do you notice in the last month or so a different feeling? A feeling of, though I talked about grace, that there's something happening. I don't know, I can't put my fingers on it, but it feels that there's a sacredness or a hallowedness about our satsang now that is different. Do you have any feedback, Joan?
Well, like I said, it's kind of hard to put your finger on it, but I have felt it. Last week, I think you had mentioned it. Well, you've mentioned it a few weeks back, but last week was the first time I'd like physically felt it, just that descent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, something's different.
Yes, worse.
No.
How about Joanne? Yeah. Yeah. It must be John's presence. He's been here for 3 weeks now, so it's got to be him. We got to find a cause. Oh, okay. Well, something's going on. I can feel it. I can feel it. I can feel it.